Hey, welcome back to the Old Gravy Podcast. I'm here with my guest today, the Duke. He's coming in, and I love having a guest because today is a podcast that, you know, I'm talking about politics most of the time. But today, it's going to be story hour with Old Gravy. And I'm glad to have you here, the Duke. How you doing?
Thanks for having me. This is awesome.
Yeah, you know why I want to have you here is because you've heard some of my stories in the past.
I've heard many of your stories,
Of course you have. And what I want to do is, like, you know, you sometimes I'll start telling a story, but if you might lose your listeners because some of these stories are kind of complex. So yeah. I'll use you as someone representing the audience.
All right.
To stop me and say, wait a second, I want to ask you a question. What are you saying here? So let me tell you what Story Hours is about on the Old Gravy Show. So there's an event that happens in the news and it has some societal impact. And believe it or not, Old Gravy, or you can call me OG, the old guy. So the OG has some peripheral connection to the event. And it's an event, I'm not saying I'm a main character in the event, but it's a true story. It happened. It had an effect in society. And I have kind of a peripheral contact to that. And the story that I'm going to tell today happened in 1980, in the summer of 1980, at the Metropolitan Opera House in New York City. A violinist goes missing during the performance of the Berlin Ballet. She disappears during the performance.
What was she? Did you say?
She was a violinist. She was a violinist, so she's in the orchestra pit. There's this big show going on, and she disappears. The media goes nuts after with this murder. Did I say it was a murder already?
You didn't. Yeah.
I didn't. I just let it out of the bag, but I was going to let it out of the bag in a minute. Doesn't make a difference. But she disappears and there is a murder. And the headlines in the New York newspapers, they're all over the place. The news, it's the Phantom of the Opera. That's what they're calling it. They're calling it murder at the Met. This is a really big deal in 1980 when this violinist cannot be found during the performance or after the performance, only to be found out later she's been murdered. And they called them the Phantom of the Opera. And the Phantom of the Opera didn't come out to 1986, the Broadway musical. And once again, this is 1980. So the real Phantom of the Opera was based on a novel in the early 1900s. And the guy who wrote it was a theater critic. He wrote detective novels and he wrote The Phantom of the Opera and it became a very famous book, but Andrew Lloyd Webber wouldn't make it into a musical to 1986. But in 1980, the newspapers in New York City were calling this, The Phantom of the Opera. And have you ever seen the show?
I have not.
It's a musical. It's about this a brilliant musician who lives in the bowels of the Paris Opera House. Okay. And it's like a maze down there. There's basements and he lives down there and he falls in love with the female soprano singer. But then there's a murder, a stagehand is murdered and that becomes a musical. But what's interesting about the Phantom of the Opera and the novel is that the murdered person is a stagehand in the novel from the early 1900s. The guy who wrote it wrote detective stories in Paris as a writer to make extra money. But what's interesting in this story, we're gonna talk a lot about the detectives who were involved and we're gonna talk about a stagehand. So that's where we're going with it. All right. And we're going to be right back. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in a minute. So this is where we are. So it's New York City. It's the late 70s. Well, actually, it's 1980, but they've just come through the late 70s. I'm talking Son of Sam, the murderer, the blackouts. New York City is really Gotham. It is... some people would refer to it as it was a hellhole in certain areas in New York. It was Gotham, and and I know that too because I, as a kid in 1978, 79, I'm taking the subways up to Yankee Stadium to be a vendor, and going through some of the worst neighborhoods. And believe me, your head was on a swivel.
And where were you living at this time?
I'm over in Jersey.
Okay.
So I'm taking the bus in, and then I'm taking the subway up. And New York is, you know, as a kid, I'm looking around like, wow, this is a wild, wild place. The fact that my parents are letting me go, that's another whole story. But when, so what happens with this murder that goes on with the violinist in the Metropolitan Opera House, this is where the culture is. This is where civilized people are. The last thing the rich and the elites and the politicians want to have at this moment in time is to have a violinist murdered in the Metropolitan Opera House during a performance where all these cultural people come. There is going to be hell to pay for this. They better. This is a big problem, and it's big news because it's
big
very
problem
unusual.
In high society.
Absolutely. Yeah. High society. So what's my connection with the Metropolitan Opera House? Well, my dad is a New York stagehand, and he's also a New York City police officer. So to give you a little background, my dad worked at the Metropolitan Opera House. He would work 4 to 12. He'd go in as a policeman from 4 to 12 at night, zip down to the Metropolitan Opera House from 12 to 6 or 7 in the morning. And he did this for about 10 years at the Metropolitan Opera House. They were called the Night Gang. There was no show going on, but they were getting the place prepared for the next day.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. What do they do during that time?
Yeah, they're getting all the sets
props
and
ready.
Everything, okay. The props. They're getting everything ready for the next day. And he did that for 8 or 10 years. You talk about a schedule, huh?
Yeah.
That's hustling. That's
police officer and then go in and do that up.
And he did it for like 8 or 10 years. So that's my connection to the metro.
Was there other police officers that did this, or was your dad?
I don't know many. I'm sure there were some police, but I didn't know many.
You didn't. Okay.
This was. I think it was. It wasn't
unique
that common. It was unique to my dad, but I'm sure there was a few other cops that did it too.
Yeah.
And as we go through this story, I want to put a little bit of this is kind of a disclaimer. Because we're going to be talking about a lot of things, but what this murder happened 43 years ago. She was a 30-year-old violinist. Her name was Helen Mintix, and I'm going to just call her the violinist because there's too many names throughout this story. So she was 30 years old. She was happily married. She was a Juilliard graduate. She was raised on a farm in Western Canada, and this. As I dug in more into this story, even though I have a story about it and I'm connected to it, but the more I dug in for this podcast, the sadder this story became for me. Because I kind of looked at it and, you know, her beautiful life was cut short. And it's just sad. I swear to God, I hope there's a heaven because when someone gets their life cut out like that, it's really so unfair. So I'm going to keep moving on to what happened that night. Now, another connection I have, which is another big connection, is my brothers and I were also stagehands. So we know the stagehand world. We were there through high school and college.
Right.
So I never worked at the Metropolitan House. I've been there. I saw a performance there, but I never worked backstage. But I've worked in a lot of other television studios, and I worked on Broadway shows. So that night during the performance, the Berlin Ballet had three Russian defectors who were performing. They back in the 80s and the 70s, you remember the Russians saying, I'm getting out of Russia.
Yeah,
I'm
absolutely.
A volleyball player. I'm a performer. I'm going to stay in America and just go hide out at a hotel and hide in America, and then they'll accept me. Because that was a big thing that was going on. So there's three Russian defectors that are performing in this ballet that night. And what happened...
Performing. They're not in the orchestra.
No, they're performers. And they're kind of, they're celebrities now. Not only because they were defectors, they were great ballet people back in Russia.
Sure.
So that just adds a little bit more to the night and the mystery. And I think they were guest performers. And they were going to be coming to the Met to do more shows. So what happens is the violinist leaves the orchestra pit for intermission. And there's going to be a little more extra time because the Berlin Ballet plays their own music on a tape at some point in the performance. Yeah. So she leaves the orchestra pit, and she's going to go try to find one of these Russian ballet stars, I think the star. And she wants to talk to him. She has some type of connection to him, but she's going up to meet him because she really wants to ask him about getting her husband a job as a set designer. Mm. And you know how that works, yep, in the world.
Absolutely.
The Duke would know that better than anyone. Yeah. If there's someone, a big performer can kind of help you get what you need.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so she's going, she wants to meet with him, but she did have some type of connection. So before I get into what happens to her, it's very important to know this Metropolitan Opera House is gigantic. It's a maze. There's rehearsal studios, there's closets, there's warehouses and dressing rooms and orchestra rooms. This place has six floors going up and it has three sub basements.
Okay.
And hundreds of people come in and out of this place every day during a performance. So think about that. How is a woman murdered with all this going on? But describing the facility and what can go, how big it is and how complicated it is, you'll realize how something like this could possibly happen. Anyway, the violinist heads to the elevator, doesn't really know. She actually says she steps on an elevator. There's a guy on the elevator who looks like Crew, and then there's a ballerina. The ballerina is going up to go to one of the dance studios there and practice. When she gets on, the violinist says to the ballerina, "Do you know where where the stars of the show, where their dressing rooms would be?" And the ballerina says no. And at that time, the door opens and it steps out. There's a stagehand there. That's who she sees in the elevator, is a stagehand. He's 21 years old. His name is Craig Crimmins. He looks at her and he says, "I think it's on second or third floor." And she goes, "Oh, okay, the door's shut." As the elevator starts to go up, he moves towards her and he says to her, he makes a very aggressive sexual pass at her. She smacks him. And this kind of infuriates him.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
How do we know that?
How you will know, because I don't want to give it away,
okay.
But I want to say this. That's a great question. How would we all know this? So everything that I'm going to tell you leading up, I'll reveal to you at the end how it is. But you're right on target. You're like a detective. You're a detective. So that's a very good question. So anyway, he gets smacked by her, and
she gets smacked by him. Right?
No, she smacks him.
That's
she
right.
smacks him. He's pissed about it. And he hits the elevator and he kind of grabs her and says, "Come with me." And what he does is he takes her off the elevator on another floor and then takes her down through these winding staircases. And there's a performance going on. He takes her down through this winding staircases. He takes her down to a bottom floor. She actually at one point tries to escape. Like tries to open the doors. He knows those doors are locked. He knows his way around the place. Mm-hmm. He then takes his hammer out from his tool belt. Now she's nervous because now she knows she's in trouble. He takes her down to the bottom of this staircase and he attempts to rape her. He makes her take her clothes off. He attempts to rape her. And I got to give you some of the details here, even though it's kind of uncomfortable, but she removes a tampon and that will become part of the case. She also, her hairpins fall out and a flower falls out down at this lower level. These three things are at like this bottom of the stairwell. Yeah. Now he attempts to rape her, but fails. He does ejaculate and they will get, you know, the crime scene will come and get that because he like rubbed up against her, but he never did rape her. And this will all come out, you know, with the autopsies and everything. So she kind of feels that this time, like once it's, well, now these are people, what they thought she thought, like they can't be, they thought he would, they thought he would take off at that point, but he doesn't. And she's kind of being nice to him, like kind of like pleading with him at this point, but like, okay, you're done with me. Like kind of let me go. And he would reveal this later when he talks to the detectives. That's how I know this information. Make a long story short, he grabs her. He brings her across the building through all these different stairwells, brings her up to the roof of the building, which is six floors up. He brings her up to the roof, the top of the roof. He ties her up. He ties her up and he puts her down. He tells her, I'm going to call someone and tell them you're up here. Now, you got to remember, this is a 21-year-old kid.
Yeah.
He has just committed something and he's probably in a little bit of a panic.
Sure.
So he ties her up and he goes around the corner and he just stops to listen. And the next thing you know, she's kind of coming around the corner. She's gotten her legs out of the ropes. He's exasperated. He grabs her. He gets more rope. He ties her up. He then uses rags to gag her, ties up her hands really hard. And he puts her down next to these, and he picks her up and he lowers her down into this thing on the roof where there's a bunch of fans. He walks away from her. And all of a sudden he's like, okay, that should do it. But boom, she's kicking like a mule to get out of being tied up. He goes back again. And one thing he's done the second time he brings her back is he cuts all her clothes off. After he attempted to rape her, he let her put her clothes back on, brings her upstairs. First time ties her up, she comes running around the corner. Second time, he takes her shoes off, uses stuff to gag her, and he cuts all her clothes off, thinking in a ridiculous thought, and he had told the detectives this, that if she was naked, she'd be too embarrassed to run away.
Right.
But this is telling us something about his intent, okay? So we'll save that for later, but it is telling us something about his intent. So as he goes back the second time, and this is the horrible part, he goes back, he's exasperated, she's kicking and fighting, banging on the metal of these giant fans that are making so much noise. There is a ventilation shaft. He literally picks her up head first and throws her down.
Holy.
She goes down and it's a brutal fall. It's a 30-foot fall and she's probably dead by the time she hits the ground because there's things inside there jutting out. But it's a horrible death and a horrible thing he did, throwing her down there. Okay. So that has occurred all during the performance. No one knows.
So she doesn't make it back for the performance. Obviously, she's not there, and nobody's out looking for her at this time.
No, they
just continue on with the performance.
But what's going on is the fellow musicians in the orchestra are like, where the heck is she? She's not this type of performer. She doesn't just disappear.
Yeah, get up and walk away.
So matter of fact, the bassoon, I don't even know what a bassoon is, but he's kind of like the captain of the orchestra. He's very concerned. Her friends are really concerned. Like two of the women that play right next to her, like, this is odd. Her husband even comes to pick her up. He'd come every night to pick her up after the show. She had a happy marriage. Obviously, he'll be questioned very closely too, like within hours of her being missing. So what happens is the New York police are notified at about midnight. And the local precinct sends over a couple of cops who call in a couple of more cops because this is kind of a weird story. And the people from the orchestra, the guy who I said was like the captain, the bassoon player, is, you know, stressing to the police, this is very unusual. Met security is there. They have their own security. I don't think it's anything special, but it's kind of, you know, security people. And they're like, you know, asking questions. They're trying to figure it out. And what the first thing the cops do is they go out to the neighborhood bars. They want to see if she's drunk in a bar. Then they send they make calls to the local hospital. Like, where can this violinist be? Mm. How does she disappear during a show? So what happens is they call up. They're there a few hours, the cops, and they've probably brought a few cops in from the precinct.
Yeah.
They call this special unit, detective unit, that works from midnight to 9 in the morning. They're kind of like the top detectives. There's like 8 of them that work there every night because each precinct has their own detective, but they have this special task force detective to come there, carry things overnight if something big ever happened and the local precinct detectives aren't probably in at midnight.
Right.
They go home, they work during the day. So they call this group and they send down this guy, Detective Jerry. That's all I'll call him, Detective Jerry. And he's a specialized detective. And he comes in into the Met at about 3 in the morning. The first thing he hears is her violin was left under her chair. And Detective Jerry has a friend who's a musician on Broadway who's a violin player. And his friend never leaves his violin anywhere. It's like that's something violin people who are real musicians
wouldn't leave it laying there
if she was trying, you know, if she wanted to leave work that day or whatever. So that gives him that gets his detective instincts yeah. up. Like, what the heck's going on here? This is weird. Because there's a lot of people walking around this place all concerned about where this young violinist
right.
is. So they commence a little bit of a search that night. And he's walking through this giant facility. And like there's Romeo and Juliet's balcony. There's an army truck. There's these big black drapes like we're you see here, but these things go up 50 feet. There's giant scenery. He's like, it was like spooky and surreal, like trying to look for someone in this yeah. metropolitan opera house. So one of the, you know, now it's daybreak. They stay all night. But now they have a lot of work to do. So they actually start setting up a mini office in the, like a police station
sure.
where the detectives are going to work. And then the local detective, Detective Mike, comes in because this is his territory. This is his precinct. He's going to have to work with this Detective Jerry. So, and there's other detectives there too, but these are the two leads, Detective Jerry and Detective Mike. So one of the other detectives say, you know, I heard her, I was talking to some people, her mother was sick. Maybe she took off on a plane. Now, Detective Mike, who's only been there a couple hours looking around, talking to people, he says, she's not on no plane. She's in this building and she's dead. And that's what he says to the other police officers.
He just has a feeling?
That's his instinct.
Yeah, yeah,
he's heard enough already.
Yeah.
The violin, there's something wrong here.
Right.
So he pretty much says there, and no one wants to hear that, but that's what he says, and he will be so right.
Yeah.
So they also find she never changed back into her street clothes. They go to her locker early in the morning. Her street clothes, she was wearing orchestra blacks. And I've worn them too. You wear black not to take away from the show. You can kind of sit in the dark. It's harder to see.
Exactly.
Someone could see if they wanted to, but she never changed out of those. Her street clothes were still in the locker. So these are all the bad signs. They just keep adding up. So they've set up their command unit, and then it's early in the morning, and they're about to set up a huge search party. To go look from the beginning to the top. Before they have to do that, a maintenance man comes flying down with a cop who says, this maintenance guy, he brings him into the detectives, and he says, I just saw a woman's pair of shoes on the roof. I turned the fans on, and I also saw some garments coming out of one of the shafts or something. And he's white as a ghost. They all head to the roof really quick. And, you know, they go up there, and now they got they got Met security, they got cops, they got the detectives. They're all over the roof. They look over the roof to make sure she didn't commit suicide. But there's no one down there. And even trying to get up and over, they rule it out pretty quickly. Within a few more minutes, you hear a cop yell, oh God. He's looked down the shaft. There she is.
Mm.
So we're going to take a break and we're going to be right back. So where we left off is they found the violinist at the bottom of that ventilator shaft.
Yeah. And just quickly, one question for you.
Yeah.
Was your dad there at this time?
No, he's not working there. He's working on Broadway. He's at a different theater, okay. Different show, but he's not at this time. But he knows a lot of the people there.
Sure.
As do I know some of them too. And that's going to tie into my story later. So the papers are going nuts. Like, now the news is out. They have a dead violinist who was killed during a performance. This, now the whole headlines are New York Daily News, Phantom of the Opera, murder at the Met. It's on every local news station. If you live in New York, every paper, everyone's talking about this. I even remember it as a kid, like following it. So this is 1980. I was a sophomore in high school. I was like, wow, this was a big story. And everybody was kind of in that. Everyone was captivated by it.
Right.
And it's weird. How'd she end up there during a performance?
Yeah.
So what they do is now the detective work starts. Now they got to figure out who did this and how and answer all those questions, and they got to make an arrest. They got to bring someone to justice. And
They have gone down. They found the body. Fired. And they're tied up. All that stuff.
All that. She's tied up. She's bound. She's found down there. And the one good thing is, as they're all up on the roof and they find the body, there were a lot of people. And now what happens is they call in a special team, a forensic team. They come in and they're going to take fingerprints up there. But the fingerprint guy grabs a giant, gets a really clean palm print. But the two detectives, this is really critical, and I'm glad we're right there. This palm print, the detectives are not that excited about it, like, because the guy says, listen, I got a good palm print here. And then the two detectives are like, get everyone off this roof, because they're thinking it's probably just another cop's palm.
Sure.
So they chase everyone off the roof, but they get this good palm print. And we're going to come back to that, because that palm print is going to play a big role in solving, you know, the murder at the Met. Now comes the challenge. They're going to have to interview like 200 people, over 200 to 800 people come through this place every day. And I'm not talking about people coming to watch the show.
Right.
Vendors, deliveries. Yeah, there's a ton of people that work in this place, and they're going to have to interview a lot of people, and that is going to be a huge problem. But why the detectives are confident that they're going to get every resource they need, because the higher-ups are going to want this solved. And my dad, being a police officer, once said to me, do you know money solves crimes? Have you ever heard that?
No, but I can understand that.
Because say you want to solve this crime like this, you need 200 guys, you need a bunch of overtime, you need the photographer that took the pictures to get them back to you in 4 hours, and they did.
Yeah.
You need the best coroner to come in and get you the results, not in 14 days, in 3 days or 2 days. So this is what starts going on on this crime scene. They're moving.
They're really, bringing the best of the best.
They're bringing the best of the best. And they also think they've narrowed it down pretty quickly. These two detectives, Detective Mike and Jerry. Detective Jerry, the violinist was tied in a very common knot that stagehands use.
Yeah.
And so they're going to interview everybody, but that knot is important.
Yeah.
They've
already started to narrow down their suspects.
They all started to narrow it down, and they're like, let's take a good close look at these stagehands. Now, getting the stagehands to cooperate people want this murder solved, but this stagehand union is the tightest father-son stagehand union in the city of New York. Like, it is... This is a tight, tight union.
Right.
I'd go to work some days. Say there were 25 guys on the floor. There were only four last names. I'm not kidding.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's all brothers and fathers working together.
Yeah, I'll give and then I'll jump back to the case, but I'll give you a little kind of story to give you an example. I'm 15. I don't know how I got to. I get called in with my dad with him to go work on Singing in the Rain. I think I'm not 100% sure. I think it was this show. I weigh about 135 pounds. I haven't grown yet. I'm working on this. I don't know what I'm doing. But I'm getting paid a man's wage, like a really good New York Manhattan stagehand wage.
And union wages.
And my dad hands me off to one of his best buddies who's 15 years younger than a big strapping guy that I could do a podcast on him.
Right.
But during the, when a show, throwing out a show or bringing a show in, there's a lot of work. And these stagehands are very creative. They build all the scenery and they put it all together. They make that thing come to life. But once the show starts, there's not a lot to do. You get it.
I've seen it, yeah.
Yeah. So I think I have three cues that day. And this guy, my dad's friend, I'll call him Stevie.
Yeah.
He's told by my dad, keep an eye, you know, manage him. They know, basically I'm there to get a check. I'm not very helpful. As we go out, when there's a break in the scene or going from one set to the next set, you know, it's a live performance. We got to push this thing. And it's like Grand Central Station. And I remembered it was really dark. All I remember as we go out, like I have no idea where I am. This Stevie's got me by the back of my pants, literally carrying me as we're both pushing it. But my feet aren't touching the ground. I'm not joking. My feet are not even touching the ground. We go out to do it again. I think the second and third time, he didn't literally pick me right up. But all he was, you know, all I was there to do was just follow him and get my paycheck.
Exactly.
So getting back to the cooperation of the stagehands, this is a very small, tight-knit father-son union.
So nobody's really going to talk. Nobody wants to really...
They are going to talk, but the detectives didn't know. Like they knew they were dealing with a very tight knit crowd. I don't know if they made a complete judgment on it, but I just read how they were kind of like, "All right, we're going to have to deal with these guys."
Yeah.
So what they another piece of evidence when she was the attempted rape happened down in the basement. The flower fell out, her bobby pins fell out, and there was a tampon. Another thing that confirmed that it had to be someone intimate with the Metropolitan Opera House was the way the crime scene went from one spot without being detected all the way up to the roof. So that was another big puzzle, that there it's someone that works in here, and stagehands would know their way around it pretty well. Yeah. Matter of fact, security had said, when they were organizing the big search before they found the body, the Met security guys go, we don't really know our way around. We know our own little sections, but there's some spots we never even go to here.
Sure.
Like we have no clue. That's how complicated the building was. Another thing that the detectives ran into is there was a lot of stuff going on backstage. Like when they were trying to take semen samples and stuff, there was a lot of this. One detective said, this place has had so much sex backstage, it's worse than Plato's Retreat, which was a very big, well-known sex club in New York City. They were dealing with stuff like that. But they start the interviews now. But what happens? This is how detective work. I bring you in. You're a stagehand. I use you to find out what you were doing that night, but you also confirm the other stagehand story. Because that's like, I'd be like, sure. Oh, you say, I was here, you were here. Well, you work with stagehand Crimmins. Was he with you the whole time working over there? And he's like, no, matter of fact. So let me get into that. So what happens is Craig Crimmins goes in for his first interview. the 21-year-old yep. murderer. We yep. all know he's the murderer. He goes in for his first interview. It goes fine. He said he didn't miss any cues. That, you know, it was, he answered, his interview went okay. He right. didn't miss any cues. Everything was good. But what happens is the other stagehands who came in and said, no, he missed his cues that night. And we had to go looking for him. So now they got to bring Crimmins back in for a second interview. They bring him back in for the second interview and they say, hey, listen, some of the guys, your story's not lining up with their story. They said they had to go find you, that you they went looking for you to find you, that you had missed your cues that night. He goes, yeah, I'm sorry, I lied. He goes, I lied because I thought you guys would tell my boss and then I'd be in trouble if you told my boss that I missed my cue. So now he's changing his story. And what, so then they ask him, well, where were you? He said, well, I actually was sleeping over in the prop in the rear wagon or whatever. And they're like, okay, all right. Then, boom, they have other. And then they bring in other stagehands. No, Johnny was sleeping there. He always sleeps in there. And he says, no, Crimmins wasn't in there. They bring him back in for a third interview. Now, on the third interview, he says he was drunk. So now they keep catching him.
Yeah.
And in the third interview, they bring him in. He said he got really drunk and he passed out in the electrician's room. But they talk to the electricians and the electrician says, and they got to admit, because they're scared. You come in with these detectives.
Oh, yeah.
You don't want to be convicted of anything yourself, of lying or whatever. The other electrician says, it was impossible he was in here sleeping on the couch because I had my girlfriend in here and I was doing coke and we were in here. Now, this is 1980.
It
was still like the Wild West.
Yeah, believable.
Yeah. And so now they got him. They got a lot of the lies are
pile up
on him. But what you don't want him to do is get suspicious because he could lawyer. They don't want him to lawyer up. They want him to confess. That's what they want, because
right.
that's a clean arrest. They got you. They want a confession. So they are worried now. They feel they got their guy. But now they know. Guess what comes back, and they know they got their guy. The palm print.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Remember I told you about the palm print? So they know. And they even knew before the palm print came back, because the guy from the police department that came in to give the fingerprinting and the palm prints, he calls up to the guys and he goes, hey, listen, I just did a Crimmins stagehand. And they're doing all the stagehands,
right.
Fingerprints and palm prints. This guy Crimmins came in. I thought he was going to hyperventilate when I was taking his prints. I just want you guys, I don't know anything. I just want you guys, I'm just relaying that information to you. And what's weird is other stagehands, three or four of them refused to give their prints. And their stories, all their alibis in the interviews, all panned out.
Yeah,
all
yeah.
panned out. So they're hot on the trail now. They know they got their murderer. They got the palm print, but now they want to make the confession, and they are worried if he gets a lawyer, everything gets a lot more complicated. But they have been giving him his Miranda rights. I think they were doing that
sure.
to everybody when they were coming in. Now we're going to go to my connection, the old gravy connection here. So the murders in 1980. We're going back in time to 1974. I'm swimming in my pool in the backyard. It's a beautiful summer afternoon. A car pulls up with two couples. The two couples come into my house. My dad's all excited to see them. But this is not a planned meeting that people were coming over. But that's what people did back in the 70s. 1974, if you were in the area, didn't have cell phones, you come and visit. So these two couples come in and I know they're stagehands, and my dad has stagehand friends. My mom is kind of like preparing now that we have unexpected guests, but that's the way it was. And the people are in the backyard. There's other kids swimming in my pool. It's a 4-foot above ground pool. But
And these are stagehands, not police officers.
No, these are stagehands. Not
girlfriends
not,
or whatever.
Yeah, the stagehands and their wives.
And their wives, I'm sorry.
Stagehands and their wives, and they're in the backyard. And I don't know them. I've never seen them before. I've never met them before. But my dad has a lot of stagehands friends.
Sure.
And they're actually fun, interesting people. We'd go to picnics and stuff. And
yeah.
There were a lot of great, really nice, great people. So I'm swimming around in the pool. And everyone's drinking Schaefer beer, not me. I'm only like 10 or 11. And kids are in and out of the pool, but I'm under there with my mask and snorkel. And I look to my right and I see one of the guys, the best way to say it is he like diddles her under the water. And in no way was it like done like because he thought anyone would see it. It was like who would think that old gravy's under the water with a mask, you know, spying on you? Not that I was even spying. I just caught it
It just happened.
It happened. And so no big deal. I understand men and women, even at 10 or 11, you get what's going on in the world to a certain extent. And so after everyone leaves, I'm hanging out with my mom and we're just talking about the party that day and who they were. And they're like, oh, my mother's like, well, Mr. Crimmins works. This is Mr. Crimmins. This is the father of the murderer. He works at the Metropolitan Opera House. He was there that night. So that's
wow.
Mr. Crimmins and his wife, who are the parents of Craig Crimmins, who committed the murder. The other guy is an electrician. I don't even have to say his name, but he's married too. And he's also a boss of like the electricians, and he works in the Metropolitan Opera House. But this is 6 years before the murder.
Right.
But my mom starts telling me who's married to who. And I'm like, no, mom, that brunette is married to Mr. Crimmins and the blonde is married to the electrician. And my mother's like, no, that's not who's married to who. And like, I know my mom doesn't know them that well either.
Right.
I'm like, oh my God, my mom's so dumb. My dad has friends come over. She doesn't even know who's married to who. How embarrassing is that? I'm 10. I'm embarrassed for her, right? So we're going to take a break and we're going to come back. And I got to tell you when I figured this all out. Okay, so I'm frustrated with my mom not knowing who's married to who. Now, we know that it's Mr. Crimmins and Mrs. Crimmins and then the head electrician and his wife. Okay, so now we're going to go to 1984. Okay, it's 1984, 4 years after the murder.
Right.
So 4 years after the murder, I'm working at Search for Tomorrow at Reeves Teletape on the Upper West Side in New York. I'm a stagehand. I've been suspended from college. Who gets suspended from college? I'm suspended.
That's a
whole nother podcast. I'm suspended for college just for winter break. Okay. And of course, I'm suspended. My family, my parents, not happy with
me. They're thrilled with you.
They're thrilled with me. And I am now working, but making good money over at on the soap opera Search for Tomorrow. So while I'm there, I see this guy reading a magazine. It's this one right here. It's Penthouse Magazine from 1984. And what's so interesting, I was able to buy this offline for $7. And in Penthouse, and let me tell you, it says famous crimes, how two cops solved the murder at the Met, right?
Yeah.
So now the pool, my mother doesn't, we're talking about.
Wait, what's the date of that? That's 84?
This is 1984,
four years after.
They do a complete expose. I've read a lot about what happened in this crime, but the best article, which I just got to read recently, was in Penthouse.
Really?
And it was really good. So anyway, I'm working at Search for Tomorrow. I can put the magazine down unless you want to go through it. So I'm sitting there and I see this guy, and he worked at the Met when this all went down. Big family, they all work as stagehands.
Yep.
So when he's done reading the magazine, he says to me, he goes, "Hey, old gravy." They didn't call me old gravy back then
because
I wasn't old. Oh, gee, old guy. They weren't calling me old gravy back then. So anyway, he goes, "You want to read it? It's about Craig Crimmins." He knows I know who the family is and the whole story or whatever. I said, "Yeah, I'd like to read it." So I'm sitting there in some prop room. I read the article and I read that the electrician ended up marrying Crimmins' divorce, Mrs. Crimmins' divorce, Mr. Crimmins' to marry that electrician. Yes. At that moment, I had the epiphany that's what I saw in the pool.
With three goggles on in the pool.
Yeah, my mom wasn't crazy. She knew who everyone was married to. She just didn't know who was getting diddled by who. And listen, and I don't mean to, they were all good people. And listen, that's life. Things happen in life. I'm not making any judgment on them. But they were my father's friends, and I'm sure they were good people. They weren't close friends. But anyway, they just happened to have old gravy with a mask on. And I dimed that out to my parents and my siblings when I was in my 40s, and they all burst out laughing. they couldn't believe that happened. But I also said,
was your mom around to hear that story?
Oh yeah.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. And she bursted out laughing, like, oh my God. Because I was telling her how I was like, oh my God, my mom's doesn't know anything.
Yeah, right.
She can't realize who's married to who. So anyway, that all happened in 1984 when I was working on Search for Tomorrow. I did hear other rumors about those two couples back in the day. Something was going on. You remember the Yankees back in the day, swap wives or something?
Yeah.
Like actually, yeah. So, and that became big news. So that was a trend maybe. So anyway, I solved my own detective case, by the way.
That's right.
I finally figured out what happened in my pool. Okay, so the confession and the arrest, and we're going to get through this really quick. So it's Labor Day weekend. They're going to take a break. The detectives are going to get through Labor Day weekend. They're going to work with the DA. They're all now, they want to bring Crimmins in. They got to make an arrest now. So it goes from July to now to Labor Day, and they're about to crack the case right around Labor Day weekend. So it's not that long. I think it's July 23rd to Labor Day weekend.
Yeah.
6 weeks they're going to crack this case. So they one of the detectives goes to Long Beach Island, and he's down there, but he gets a call, and it, you know, ruining his vacation. The Daily News knows Craig Crimmins is the main suspect, and they're going to print. It's going on the printer that night at 7 o'clock. They called Jerry's still in New York at his home or whatever on Labor Day weekend. They all head to the
print. How did they think they knew that?
Someone leaked it to them.
Oh, okay.
The Daily News probably, the writer probably said, I heard this and we're going with the story.
Okay.
Now, if that story comes out, even when it goes to print that night, the guys who work on the print, they're telling their wives, they're telling their kids. So it's going to print at 7 o'clock. That's when word would get out, and then the paper will be out in the morning.
Yeah.
It's like 2 or 3 in the afternoon. They get to they meet in New York. The two detectives drive out to the Bronx where Crimmins lives. They're waiting outside his apartment. They're hoping he'll come out, or they're going to have to go in and ask him. If he comes out, he does come out. And so they can casually, one of them, who he kind of gets along with, Jerry, Detective Jerry, is a little afraid of Detective Mike. Detective Jerry's like, hey, Craig, I got to talk to you. We're still trying to tie your pieces together. Like, there's something's not. And he goes, well, I can't go in all night. And he goes, no, we need you probably. We're just going to quickly get this so we can move on. You know, he's a 21-year-old kid. And he has learning disabilities, you would hear in his defense. And I'm not sure if that was just part of the defense or he really did have it. So they put him in the car. They start heading to the precinct where now they're going to grill him. They're going to get him to confess now before he lawyers up. Meanwhile, rumors are circulating around New York already. His parents are trying to find him to get him to a lawyer because they are hearing rumors too. But the detectives grab him. They come pulling up to the precinct. They see all these news trucks out in front. Now, if Crimmins sees these news trucks, and they're bringing him in.
He's going to know what's going on.
He's not going to say a word. He'll be lawyered up at that point. At the last second, the detective chucks a right and doesn't see it and takes him to another precinct. So he doesn't get to see it.
Yeah.
So what happens is they bring him in and they start grilling him on all the inconsistencies in his story. But this is a harder interview.
Right.
This isn't like, hey, we're going to slow walk this guy and get him. They're now really grilling down. At one point, Crimmins says to the two detectives, he goes, can I talk to Jerry alone? Detective Mike steps out. Crimmins says, you know Jerry. And Detective Jerry says, I know what. And Crimmin says, I killed the lady. And that was it.
Mm.
That was it. And the confession was taken.
He confessed.
Yeah. Interesting. So he would receive 20 years to life. And then he was denied parole 7 times. And he was released after 41 years in 2021.
No kidding.
41 years he served. Yeah.
So he's still alive.
He's still alive. Yeah. Served 41 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Because if he was 21 in 1980, we could do the math, but he's in his 60s.
Yeah.
He's well into his 60s. So the jury said it was not second degree murder, meaning it wasn't premeditated, but it was called felony murder. And felony murder is the rape was during he was attempting a rape, which is a felony, and a murder occurred in it as part of it, but it wasn't the intention.
Right.
So that's why he got 20 years. And that was probably a normal sentence back in 1980. His defense was he was heavily intoxicated. I heard he might have been high. And then they used the low IQ thing. You know, here's another thing I want to dismiss because I've read so much about it. I always heard that him and the violinist, she wanted to go smoke weed with him during intermission up on the roof. That was like a stagehand story I heard, or I heard it. I had just heard it.
Really?
Yeah, but that wasn't true. Because nothing I read, and especially the article I read in Penthouse, which was a really good expose, I just think that was way of people saying like, something got out of hand. I don't know. I don't want to speak for everybody and what their thought was, but I believe that was not true, and it was a rumor. I also believe he was a 21-year-old kid that had no intention of killing her.
Yeah.
The fact that he went back and forth trying to tie her up or whatever and just made a terrible decision.
Right.
He made a lot of terrible decisions. He made a terrible decision to rape someone.
Yeah.
And I'm not giving him any leeway on that. But I am giving him a little leeway. I don't think he saw her even after she slapped him and said, I'm going to murder her.
Yeah.
I think as I laid it out here, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I don't think that he intentionally planned on killing her.
No, neither do I.
Yeah, no.
So when he was, it's funny, when he first went to jail, he was in a special wing near David Chapman.
Really?
It was just him and Chapman who killed John Lennon.
Yeah.
I thought that like captures the history of the time.
Yeah.
I mean, for the young listeners, they probably don't know what we're talking about, but David Chapman killed John Lennon in New York City.
And did he always, I know he said to Jerry, Detective Jerry, I killed her. But did he stick by that even through his incarceration and stuff? He never came back and said, it really wasn't me. I just gave in.
I've never heard that.
Okay.
I've never heard that. I think there was too much. There was just too much stuff.
Too much stuff.
And these confessions were done on tape. And the handprint, I mean, we went through it all.
Yeah.
I think they had them. And once you have a confession on tape, you pretty much got it. But this is my final thing. Another lesson that I got. In the fall of 1980, my dad was on his way out the door alone. And he wasn't going to work. You kind of know when your parents are going somewhere, or your dad's going somewhere, but he seemed to be going somewhere. And I was 16 at the time. And I knew he wasn't going to work. And I asked him, I go, where are you going? And he goes, I'm going to a fundraiser for Craig Crimmins. And I was like, I knew all about it when I was 16. I was reading it in the papers. And I knew it was my dad's friend. We talked about it at home or whatever. And my dad's a New York cop and he's going to a murderer's fundraiser. So I'm like, wait, that's kind of, you know, what's going on here? So I go to my dad, I go, what kind of fundraiser are you going to? I know he's going for Craig Crimmins fund.
Sure.
And he goes, my dad said he's going to raise money for the lawyer. I asked him why. I go, it sure looks like he's the murderer. Like, why would you go do a fundraiser? Like, why would you contribute to this? And my dad responded, everyone deserves a lawyer to defend them. And he's a cop.
Yeah.
He goes, and then he said, His dad's my friend. And
wow.
That was a good life lesson.
It
right
is.
There. Really good life lesson.
Yeah. So, that he could separate what he did for a living as a police officer, but he still had a friend whose son was in trouble.
Who was in trouble, yeah. And he was entitled to a defense.
Yeah.
So that wraps up the Old Gravy podcast, Murder at the Met.
That was a good
one. Phantom of the
Opera. That was a good one, OG.
I want to thank the Duke for coming in for the Old Gravy podcast, Phantom of the Opera, Murder at the Met. And I loved having you here. You were a big help for the audience.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Have a good night.